Ira Glass, if you listen to this station, you know who he is. He's the This American Life guy who's had crazy success telling long-form stories on the radio. Now Ira Glass is working in TV, and it's a pleasure to welcome him right back here just before he visits Kansas City this week. And Ira Glass, so good to have you again.
It's nice to be here. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm working in TV. What do you mean?
The Serial's going to be a TV show, and you have a piece of that, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I guess, in some way.
In some ways.
Sure.
But maybe not much,
I'm going to be deeply, no, my plan is to be as uninvolved in that as I humanly can. Serial is run by Sarah Koenig and Julie Snyder, the senior producer of the show and executive producer of that show. And my whole goal is to have nothing to do with their TV show, but I wish them the very, very best.
But your name's on it, Ira, just so you know.
Is that true?
I think it is. I'm reading about okay. you connected with it, so that must be.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Then I heard it here first. You're doing an excellent job informing the public, and as one of your listeners now, I appreciate the information.
There you go. Well, you once said, this is a little more serious, that it took you longer to figure out what you wanted to do and do it well than anybody you've ever met. Really?
Well, anybody I've ever met in public radio, for
mm-hmm.
sure. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah. Like I was. I mean, I was working in public radio starting when I was 19, mm-hmm. and the part that I knew, like I knew I wanted to do radio stories and make radio stories on public radio, but doing it well took me until I was 27 or so, until I was a decent writer and reporter, maybe 28, really.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when I give talks, like the one I'm going to be giving in Kansas, I play stuff, like not from my first year or second year or third year, that would be too easy, but from like year seven, and it's still just awful.
Huh.
And I say without kind of false modesty or humble bragging or something, like it's actually just gets laughs because it's not good. The way that I read, the way that I'm writing, like the stories are almost incomprehensible. I mean, I was good at some things in radio, and that's what kept me going. I was always a very good editor, and so I was able to get work as a tape cutter. But when it came to actually learning to be a reporter and to write stories and to perform my scripts on the air, like I was not very good.
And so the lesson in that for you has been what?
I mean, work, hard work, you know, can get mm-hmm. you somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny sometimes when I'm talking to college students who want to be journalists, I think that they go through a thing that that I certainly went through, which is that they wanted their work to be really special. But they knew that the work they were making was not good, and it seemed impossible to ever get good. And I think you know, people get very despairing about that, and people think like, oh, well, if you're talented, then you're just born with this
yes.
with this magical gift that you can just do things really great. But in fact, when I think about the creative people I know, I feel like I know a few who were real prodigies, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, you know, who were just amazing writers from the time they were young. I know Malcolm Gladwell was just an amazing writer straight up from when he started. And one of the producers on our staff, Hannah Jaffe Wall, was just excellent just from the very beginning. But most people, I think, are you know, people who start off like not so great and they get better. I was interested to read this profile of Tom Wolfe, the great journalist who wrote The Right Stuff,
sure.
and Bonfire of the Vanities, and his whole early reporting career was completely, utterly standard, the regular kinds of boring journalism that people did at local newspapers everywhere before he turned himself into a very different kind of journalist when he was in his, I think, his 30s.
Yeah.
And when I think about people like David Sedaris, when I first put him on Morning Edition, David was in his 30s and was cleaning apartments for a living and was, you know, and had dropped out of college over and over again and was trying to make himself into a writer. And I think it's the much more typical route, which is really hopeful for most of us, because most of us are not gifted.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like most of us, through hard work, we can get to a point where we're really good at something.
Well, the notion of hard work and in conjunction with that, producing this huge volume of work, you've said the key is sort of, you know, just doing it over and over and over again. And eventually, if you're focused and driven and ambitious and you're trying hard and you're earnest, you're going to improve, right? That's at least that's been your experience.
That's been my experience, and that's what I see with a lot of people. I mean, I assume that there are people who are never going to get to the top of the mountain.
Sure, sure.
Like some people just are never going to make it. But I think that there's a group of us who were definitely, you know, not great, who definitely can get the skills.
So this won't surprise people then that to find out that you work behind the scenes for a very long time in the course of putting in that large volume of work. What did you do?
Well, I started at NPR at 19 as an intern, and then just kind of talked my way into different jobs. I was a production assistant for a long time, which is kind of a glorified sort of tape cutting job where you take, you know, somebody with more skill goes out and does you know, an hour long or two hour long interview, and then you figure out, okay, these are the parts that are the interesting parts, and here's an order, and kind of make that work, which is a wonderful job.
Yes.
I love that. And then kind of worked my way up. I did the overnight newscast as a news writer for Carl Castle on Morning Edition back in the day. And when the old host, Bob Edwards, was host, older listeners might remember him. Like I was,
You know,
I worked on the show, and I was I worked on All Things Considered as a producer. I worked as an editor. I was the guest host of Talk of the Nation for 6 months. Another NPR show that's not around anymore. Mm-hmm. I just kind of did like sort of every job they had at NPR, and then finally sort of turned myself into a reporter and moved to Chicago and worked for NPR as a reporter, doing a lot of education stuff mostly, but general assignment out of their Chicago bureau.
When you were doing all that lower level stuff, what job did you wind up disliking the most?
I don't know what this says about me, but I disliked none of it. I mean, I think maybe that's why, like, I'm the right person to work in radio. I really, like, enjoyed all of it. And I got to work with interesting people, and it was continually hard. And it's a really lucky thing to get to do a job where you are allowed any kind of creativity. Like, it's a really lucky thing, and a lot of people don't have that. And I appreciated it very, very much. And my single goal was to have a job that I wouldn't be bored at. And I really, like, I loved being a tape cutter. I loved being an associate producer, you know, like, and it didn't seem that different than my job now. Like, every day I was sort of like coming to work, trying to think of like what would be fun to put on the air that nobody's heard before or done before. And then, you know,
and then
go for it.
You once asked to be paid less. Was that at NPR?
No, it wasn't paid at NPR because I was not paid very much in NPR.
It couldn't have been any less, yeah.
I was paid okay, but like it was, you know, I was kind of a low level employee, so I was kind of doing okay, but like, you know, not great. I asked to be paid less because it was when I was hosting This American Life and I was doing the pledge drive. I do a lot of stuff for the pledge drive, not just for my home station, WBEZ, but for stations all over the country. Mm-hmm. And WBEZ was very insistent on giving me a raise because they just felt like, well, you're doing a very nice job for the radio station and you have this national show, blah, blah, blah. And I felt like, well, I don't know. It seems weird to be making this much money and asking people to donate money. It seemed unseemly. And I was like, okay, so I think that I should make less. I don't know. It seemed fair. It seemed like I should make what you make if you're like a high school principal or something, maybe. Yeah. Or not even the principal, but the assistant principal, you know? At like a big city high school, like I don't know, like I don't know what I, maybe that's not exactly the way to say it, but like I just thought, like, yeah, it seemed like if I'm asking people, you know, of all income levels to be donating to the radio station, I would hate for them to look up online and see like I make some huge amount of money, and I feel like I do fine, like it's fine.
I'm visiting with Ira Glass of This American Life, and the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts is bringing Ira Glass in on Saturday. The show is titled Reinventing Radio, An Evening with Ira Glass, explores how he puts the show together. More information, kauffmancenter.com. You know, when I talk to people about you, Ira, the question, and this will not be news to you, but the question that comes up over and over again is how you decide on your stories for This American Life. I read an interview with you once where you said it's a very, very tough process. I'm wondering, what's so tough about it?
Well, unlike working on a news show, like there's nothing dictating what should be on our show. Like when I worked on All Things Considered, it was clear what we were doing. We were doing the news. Mm-hmm. So stuff was happening in the world and we had to cover it and had to think of interesting ways to cover it for sure. And that was a challenge and it was fun and it was really fascinating. But like on our show, there's nothing dictating why something should be on. And so sometimes we'll do newsy stuff, but sometimes it'll just be totally personal stuff. So when anything can be on, it's a lot harder to decide. And then the format of the show is such that, like, this sounds like such a like sort of specific problem, but it is a real problem. If the reason to listen to a story isn't that it's going to give you like vital information about the news, about something happening in the world that you might be curious about, then the story itself has to be so sparkly. You know what I mean? Like if there isn't the excuse of the news to put it on the air. And so what we're looking for are stories that where there's somebody to relate to and something happens to them and the plot of what happens to them. It has to have a plot. The plot has to be surprising. It has to drive at some idea about the world that you haven't heard before and or some just notion of the world, some thought. It has to drive at some thought about the world that you just haven't heard. And so that's like a huge amount of burden to put on some little radio interview. And so to make that happen, for us to find three or four stories that we think are good enough, we will run at sometimes like 10 or 15 or 20 stories, and in some cases a lot more, to find out enough stories for an episode of our show. And it'll take us months generally. 3 or 4 months is typical, but sometimes it's way longer to find enough stories that we think are at the level that our audience will like. And so the whole process is one of just kind of running at a bunch of things and then killing off, you know, half of them. Really.
I mean, when people pitch stories to you, I mean, instinctively now after doing it for so many years, can you tell within, you know, the middle of the pitch, 30 seconds in, 40 seconds in, that this is going to work or it's not?
That is such a good question. I mean, like one pitch out of 10, you can tell. And then like 2 pitches out of 10, you know for sure like that there's no way that's going to work. And then the rest are in this really hazy area that if the interviewees are good talkers and if they can address like this thing and this thing and this thing in the most interesting imaginable way, then or sometimes they really only have to answer if they have an interesting answer to one question that's the obvious question of the story. Then it can be a story. Like often we get into that, and so often, like the answer to the question of is this a story for This American Life is like we just pay the contributor to go out and just do the first interview, you know, and sometimes it goes way further than that, you know, like sometimes, you know, there's a story that we're working on that Stephanie Fu, one of our producers, is working on right now, that we're working with a really experienced reporter and a really wonderful reporter, actually, somebody who's on NPR all the time. Who we're all excited to work with because we all admire his work. And they did an entire draft of the story and we're like, no, you got to find somebody else who this happened to besides these people. And then they couldn't get anybody to talk to him. It went on a massive reporting project to find somebody, finally found somebody. Stephanie flew out to the Midwest to like get the guy on tape. He's kind of a recluse. And then they got the tape and they came back and they remade the story with that tape. And we're like, oh, but he just doesn't answer like this question, which is like the key question. So Stephanie had to go back to the guy, like reach him on the phone, which I think we had to hire somebody to drive to his house because he was such a recluse. And then they did a second, you know, long interview with this guy to like see if we could get him just to talk about, to address this other thing. It seemed really important to the story. And then in that one, I haven't heard that draft. And so it's entirely possible that we will still kill this story that we've spent as a staff. Yeah. Like I've personally spent probably 10 hours on it and Stephanie has spent easily 80 hours on it. And this contributor who is a super skilled professional, he himself has probably spent 2 weeks on it. And it's not unusual for us to like get to a point where just like the idea of the story is really good, but without the right people in it, we're just not gonna do it.
Yeah, I
feel like that's the luxury of being a weekly show. Like when I worked on a daily news show, you know, you can't do that. And I feel like you know, like when you get assigned a story, when I was an All Things Considered reporter, you know, they say like, okay, so we need you to go out to this place and, you know, this is the news and it's today. And like, you're going to be on the air at, you know, 5:18 tonight and your story is going to be 3 minutes and a quarter. And you come back and you do that story and it is 3 minutes and a quarter and not a quarter minute longer or shorter. You know what I mean? Like there's no like going out and being like, I don't know, I couldn't get the right person to talk. If you don't find the right person, you find somebody else and you make a story. And like, that is not, you know, that's not, you know, what it is to do a documentary show. Though we never use the word documentary on the air because people think documentaries are boring.
Yeah. But the world of the story sometimes works for you. And what does that mean?
I mean, the world of the story, it's funny, like you think about, like, well, why are some stories more appealing than others? I mean, and sometimes it's just there's somebody in the story who, when you hear them talk, you just fall in love with them. Like, it's just, there's just no way around it. And that's an incredibly powerful force, whether you're making fiction or nonfiction. Or there's somebody who's just compelling and mysterious. And again, you can think of all kinds of like examples in fiction or nonfiction that are like that. So that's part of it. But then sometimes just the world of the story is the thing that's so wonderful. Like one of my favorite things we have ever done was this episode we did 2 years ago, three years ago, I think this month. And we went to a car dealership in Long Island in New York, and basically we just followed one car dealership, seven salespeople, as they tried to make their monthly quota in the month of October. And they had to sell 129 cars, and it was not going well. And we had one reporter on each of the seven salespeople, and we just watched them try everything they could possibly think of. And as people, they had really different styles, and it was some of them were really funny, and some of them were very philosophical, and you know, just like everybody's sales style is very different, and they're very competitive with each other, and they're all really funny. And then the guys who ran the dealership were these super frank, super funny guys who cursed all the time, and which I love because I love it when people curse, and just like it was just really pleasant to do the report. Just kind of like to hang out with these guys. I really loved them. And then on the air, it totally has that feeling. And so sometimes we'll just do something like that. And then fortunately for us, like it was a very dramatic month for them. There was great plot to it. And so that's an example of the place being so important.
And you did one a few weeks ago about this man who had all these kids and he built this huge boat on his driveway. Tell us about that. And was that an example of the world of the story just feeling right?
Yes, though. I have to say that was a very controversial story here on our staff. Like that was a story that Miki Meek, one of our producers, did. And it was this guy who had, I can't remember, he had a lot of kids, like seven kids, 10 kids. Mm-hmm. And they were living in the suburbs in Illinois. And when the kids were little, he built this boat. He was a Navy vet, and he built this boat that was like a little Navy ship that all the kids could play in. And it was super elaborate, where like the kids were actually, there was like a store like in a real Navy ship, and the kids had to do watch at night, and somebody was in charge and was the captain, and they had different ranks, and they had to fill out forms, and they had to do requisitions, they like, you know, the kid who was the one who minded the store had a fake cigar, or not a fake cigar, like a cigar stub that, you know, was on the desk. And so it was this elaborate ongoing game that the children would play all summer long. And as the kid, and now the kids are all grown, and dad is passed away. And just the world of this story is so pleasing. But when we would do edits on the story, because when we do these stories, we edit them over and over and over. So we draft and redraft and redraft. And, you know, Miki, the reporter for this one, would you know, come to my office, and a bunch of producers would sit around, and she'd read the script and play the quotes, and we would all give notes, and she'd go back and rewrite, which is how we make all the stuff. And finally, like, we were getting to the end of doing like many, many edits. And two of the producers were just like, I don't know. Like, they're just like, I keep waiting for the twist. Like, where's the plot twist where something's going to change? And we're just like, it's not that kind of story. This is just a story of like, look at this amazing thing this guy did. And we were all just like, but where's the kid who just hated it? And we're like, dude, we looked for it. They all really liked it. It was a good dad. You know what I mean? Like, everybody was really into it, boys and girls alike. And they're like, but there must be a downside. We're like, there's not a plot twist. Okay, so you got it. And we just said, we don't know how else to write it. You know, like, this is the gig.
Was,
you know,
yeah,
this is what it was. So it was a fact-based enterprise we're running here. And we really weren't sure if people would like it. And then it was interesting, like that. And we made it the first story, so it's got to be pretty strong because you just feel like, oh, if the first story is no good, people turn off; they don't even hear the second story. And so, but we made it the first story because we just thought, like, because Miki and I loved it, you know. And I just like, I don't care. It doesn't have a plot twist. Okay, fine. I find it really interesting, the level of detail in this story, and because they would take the boat out and they would have like enemy submarines attack it, and the kids would be on watch. They would stay up all night listening to the radio and filling out reports of like raccoon got into the garbage cans and stuff like that, and just like it was crazy, the level of detail. And the little girl who was the commanding officer wasn't allowed to fraternize with her siblings. Right. Like she couldn't play cards with them or anything while they were on the ship. Like because she was their boss, you know, she had to like keep discipline, and it, you know, just every detail to me was just like, I just love the world of the story. Yeah, but like but it was sort of short on plot and thus a controversial story here in the radio staff. And I'm glad that the audience, fortunately, we got tons and tons of emails. People really liked it. But yeah.
Well, Ira Glass is my guest of This American Life. Do you have this endless list of story possibilities, Ira, or do you sometimes worry that you're running just absolutely dry?
No, I don't. I mean, you know, like sometimes we definitely like, you know, we definitely. It's not endless at all. No, it's normal. We're normal broadcasters. We're like, you know, like we're making stuff and then we're like, what do we got for next week? We got nothing? You know, we only got one story for a show that needs three stories. Like we're normal broadcasters in that way, where it's not endless at all. No. But I think you're asking something else. It's like, do we run out of ideas?
Well,
and
sure.
The answer is no. I mean, there was a point like 4 or 5 years in when it seemed like we couldn't tell, are we a show like Fresh Air where you can just keep making new ones and, you know, just, you know, keep remaking it? Or were we a show like Seinfeld where you kind of run out of the premise? And what happened was is that new staffers came in and we just sort of expanded the mission of the show. So it wasn't just personal stories, but now, like, you know, we'll take on the news and things in the news and try to apply the kind of scenes and stories to things. And the new integration of schools and things like that, and just trying to do things in our style that we think would be compelling and funny and so since doing that, it feels like no, the sky's the limit.
You're working how many hours a week?
I mean, well, I'm working more than the rest of the staff because in any given week. You know, it'll be whatever producer's putting on that week's show, and then I'm sort of in it there with them. So if I'm probably working during the week probably 70 hours. It's not bad. I mean, if I didn't like my job, it would be bad.
Yeah, right.
I don't know. Like, I don't have kids. And, so, like, obviously, like, you couldn't have children and be a responsible parent with that kind of thing. And there came a point where my wife was just like, we can't have kids because I don't want to be a single mom. And I was like, that seemed fair. And I didn't want to, you know, like I didn't, you know, I grew up like a lot of people who are older with a dad who wasn't around that much because he was off working all the time. I wouldn't want to do that to a kid. And so, like, you know, if you don't have kids and if you like what you do, like, work is play.
Monica Crane Childers asked me on Facebook to ask you, what's the most important story you haven't figured out how to tell yet?
I mean, there are certain stories that are an ongoing puzzle. Like one of the ones for sure that we keep trying to figure out how to cover, and it's really, really hard, is climate change.
Ah.
It's really hard because I think it falls into that class of stories where everybody has an opinion already, and whichever side of it you're on, if you don't think that it's real and you think it's a conspiracy by, you know, liberal scientists to get the government all up in our business, like that's what you believe. And if you think climate change is real and it's a crisis, that's what you believe. And as soon as you go on the radio and you say, okay, so we're going to talk about climate change, everybody just feels like, yeah, I know. Like I got the picture. Like if you give me just like more details about how fast the Antarctic is going to melt, like I got this one. I think there's a whole class of stories like that in the news, including the federal budget and, you know, just Guantanamo. I think there's a whole class of things that are just very hard to talk about and that are a puzzle. And for me, I think that you know, just to kind of put the cards on the table, like I'm convinced, you know, I find the science, you know, as a non-scientist, but as a reporter who looks at this, I think it seems very convincing, mm-hmm. very compelling, certainly mm-hmm. very alarming. And so I feel like, oh, this is an important thing for us to keep covering. And it's really hard to figure out ways to keep covering it that would be interesting to people.
Some personal stuff. You're a Democrat.
I mean, I have said on the air that I have often voted Democratic.
Sure.
Yes. I sometimes regret doing that. But yeah. But the truth is, like, most people assume if they know that you're a reporter that you are a Democrat, and statistically they are entirely correct. Mm-hmm. Most reporters are.
Mm-hmm. You're done with organized religion.
Well, I'm not done with it. I mean, I myself do not believe in God. But I was trained, I went to Hebrew school up through probably 10th or 11th grade. And, you know, like I, you know, I was in shul a month ago for my mom's yahrzeit. There's a, once a year you go back and say a prayer and like, but you know, like, so I don't believe myself, but I also, as somebody like reporting on life in America, I think religion is a huge important force and it's a huge thing in people's lives. And I think it's reported on terribly. I think that generally when the press reports on the religion, it does a terrible, terrible job. Just like most fiction about religious people tends to get it wrong and tends to portray, especially Christians, religious Christians, evangelicals, and fundamentalists, as kind of like these nutters. When you know, I mean, I can say from the religious Christians that I know, who I'm close to, who I've worked with, like they're, you know, they're anything but. I mean, I think all of us know like that's. I mean, I would hope everybody knows like that's not true. That's just a stereotype, and it's ridiculous. And at different points in the show's history, we've gone on kind of binges of trying to report on like the way that religion is part of people's lives in a real way, and to counter the really moronic way that it's often reported on.
You once said Harry Potter was a bore. Why?
I said Harry Potter was a bore.
I saw it. Yeah.
Well, I don't remember why I would say that. I don't remember. It seems like the sort of thing I might say, but honestly, like I've seen almost all the films and I read a couple of the books. So there are things about the Harry Potter stories that I find that I take issue with. like the fact that in the movies anyway, he keeps learning in movie after movie, like that he should rely on his friends. That's like the B plot of like a couple of the films. You just feel like, dude, didn't you see the previous movie?
Yeah.
Like Ryan, Hermione and Ron, they're there. Like they're going to help you. Trust them. You know, but I don't know why I said that.
What's the craziest thing you've ever done to get a story?
The craziest thing. I mean, there have been a lot of people, like anybody who does a lot of reporting, like there have been a lot of people you really who have no interest in being on the radio
mm-hmm.
at
mm-hmm.
all, and you really have to like talk to them but the craziest thing. I mean, we've done a lot of things where, you know, like we'll stake out somebody's house because they're not answering our phone calls,
mm-hmm.
like that. I mean, it doesn't happen very often,
right.
But we've definitely, as a staff, we've definitely done that.
Yeah.
You know, and then like just get in and talk to them. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, the most extreme version of me trying to get a story and failing and trying and failing and then finally getting the story was this thing. It was a story I stumbled on. We were doing this show that was like intended as like a little bit of a lark. Where the idea was we called it the Georgia Rambler, and we were imitating an old newspaper column from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution,
mm-hmm.
and where a guy named Salter, I think his name was a columnist, and he had this really wonderful column where every like three times a week he would just get in his car, he would drive to some small town, and he would just find a story that day. That
mm-hmm.
was his whole gimmick. He would find mm-hmm. a story. He would just like talk to people. He would find a story. He would write it up, and that would be in the paper, and he just had a real knack for it. And he, as somebody, he came from a small town. He just felt like people, you know, the city paper doesn't cover small towns around it. And we are reading the paper and we should be in the paper. And so that was a little mission. And we just thought like, what a great idea. And like, well, let's go do that ourselves. And so we talked to him and got his permission. And then we picked names of counties in Georgia out of a hat. And everybody got a different county. And I went to the county that has Brunswick, in a town of Brunswick over by the water. And And my very first, you know, so basically it was like a game. You show up and you're supposed to find a story that day. And the very first person I talked to, they pointed me to this story where they talked about this guy who had it was in a fight with this local judge, Amanda Williams. Mm-hmm. And then people would were telling me about this judge. And then kind of like the next person I talked to, I'd say like, you know, I was looking for a story and ask them like, what's going on? And whatever they would say, I would say like, hey, have you heard of this judge? And everybody had heard of this judge and everybody had a story about this judge. And some of the stories people were telling me, I was like, wow, if that's true, like a reporter should really do a real story on that. And then I would think like, oh, I guess I am a reporter. and then like, you know, the stuff they were saying was so disturbing and not the sort of thing like you could confirm in a day. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And so actually I did kind of work up a little version of it, but then, you know, ended up kind of doing something else for my like turnaround in a day story. But it just really stuck with me. I kept going back down there trying to run down whether or not these stories were true. And for months, I couldn't get anybody to go on the record. People would tell me incredible things and people just would not go on the record. And this is true, I think, anywhere. Like, it wasn't her in particular, but people don't want to cross a judge in a small town. You know, like even if, you know, just like, it wasn't that she was especially whatever. Like, that would be true for any judge, I think. And so nobody would go on the record, but the things people were saying were so disturbing. And truthfully, for a long time, I didn't know if they were true. Like, I really, really couldn't tell. And I would go through court records, and I would just run down one case after another and talk to all these lawyers. And again, like, nobody would go on the record. Mm. And then I wrote up a version of the story with what I had, and it took, you know, a couple of weeks to write it up. But because I had, like, some court records, it raised some interesting questions and things that I could say. And I played it for the staff, and they're just like, no, this you don't have it. You don't have it. Like, you got to kill it. And then I kept going back down it. And, like, seriously, my senior producer and my wife were just like, just why will you not let this go? Yeah, mm-hmm. let it go. And I just felt like, no, I'm about to get it. And then finally this one young woman who had been put in prison by Judge Williams, who I'd been trying to reach, and she was incarcerated. And, you know, so I wrote a letter to her. That was the only way I could reach her. Like, I wanted to go talk to her, but you can't talk to her unless you have permission from her. And even though her lawyer thought, okay, well, she wants to do it, like, whatever. And so, like, a month after I wrote to her, I got a letter back from her saying, like, sure. And then it took another, like, 6 weeks to get the Department of Corrections to let me in. And then she gave me the story. So we did the story, and then somebody else came forward, and I got a second story. So, like, it was a good break.
It paid off.
Somebody got out of prison and gave me a second story that was decent too.
Wow.
And so then I had two examples, and I could prove it in the court records. And Judge Williams, there's a body in Georgia that you know, if a judge is you know, doing things a judge shouldn't do. They knock him off the bench,
mm-hmm.
and when they went after Judge Williams, like, their main evidence was this one girl.
Yeah.
Like, this girl stepped forward and went public. Like, and Judge Williams is not a judge anymore. In fact, there's a criminal prosecution against her.
That's interesting. That's a great story. You know, final question: is being a radio icon a cool thing or a drag?
It's mostly nothing. It's mostly nothing. Like, mostly nobody knows who I am, and I'm totally anonymous. And, you know, like, I was on a plane yesterday and sat next to some lady who was wearing a Bernie Sanders T-shirt. And so at some point I was, like, very curious to talk to a Bernie Sanders supporter. And
mm-hmm.
and I asked her if she watched the debate. She's like, no, I don't watch a TV. I get all my news from NPR.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, you listen to a lot of NPR, do you? She had no idea who I was. She's like,
really?
Yeah, I listen to it all the time.
Really?
I said, yeah, and I'm on NPR. But it's like, that's how famous I am. In the coach section of United Airlines, I can't get recognized by one of our own listeners.
Well, Ira Glass, he'll be at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts on Saturday. The show is titled Reinventing Radio, An Evening with Ira Glass. More information, kauffmancenter.org. Ira, what a pleasure to have you. We'll look forward to seeing you on Saturday, and thank you for the time.
Thanks so much for talking to me.
You
bet.
That
was really fun.